Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back. Another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation that I'm hoping helps your business grow. Now, you're listening to Startup Hustle. We just confirmed that. We started, and we, meaning my often co-host, Matt Watson, started this podcast because we felt that entrepreneurs needed advice related to startups. We've come close to publishing 400 episodes. We've had listeners in 190 countries. We've been in the top 20 for entrepreneurship podcasts on Apple. And yet we have never done an episode simply about general advice for startups. We've covered a whole lot of different stuff. Now, before I get into the subject matter expert I've brought in today, I do need to let you know that today's episode of Startup Hustle is sponsored by Fullscale.io. We help you build a software team quickly and affordably. I mentioned I have a guest today. Now, for those of you that listen to the show often, you know that I have dropped out of five colleges. This guy's got a doctorate from Princeton. So he's also funded or been involved in the funding of 70 different companies. He's a biotech entrepreneur. He's a chief science officer at Wild Earth. And to generally introduce him, he is an entrepreneur, an investor, and an innovator. Ron Shigeta, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity that I have to mention that I have dropped out of too many schools. But it's always fun. I like to think that's empowering for those that don't feel that they went to Princeton or somewhere else, which is obviously amazing. But at the same time, not something that many of us do. Now, before we get into this, you've done so many different things. I want to give you an opportunity to set the table here about and tell us a little bit more about yourself and, you know, like why you can offer some advice related to startups.
Thanks. I've had, you know, basically, Matt, you know, I had the advantage of going to a good school and I had a great education, but I still didn't really know how to get what I wanted in life. And I had been working in industry and had a great job, but I was just unhappy. And I'd moved to San Francisco Bay Area to try to sort of become more entrepreneurial. And I really hadn't done it. I'd been here like 12 years. So a friend and I started our own entrepreneurial businesses after work. And long story short, we ended up being biotech entrepreneurs. And we helped found an accelerator, which is a program that bring small teams in to work with them for a few months, called IndieBio in San Francisco downtown. And we were the first accelerator exclusively for biotech. And it was a real thrill. It's just something that hadn't existed before. I was an investor, but it was also a startup. And we built and built and built. In about 3 years, we had invested in about 70 companies, and each one of those companies we got to work with for 3 or 4 months and just tried to find, help them find a way to become viable and important, good assets and good investments. And it worked out all right. I mean, it basically started a trend in startups for biotech. And the portfolio market cap, this is say the, if you add all the value, enterprise value of all the companies in the portfolio, it's a little over $3.5 billion now, about 5 years out. So that was a crazy ride. Then we did a little startup called Wild Earth and raised like $15 million for that. We were on Shark Tank and we were the first startup investment on Shark Tank, really, from the Valley. And I left the company last year and I work with teams now and do startup full time.
So that's a lot of stuff, man. And congrats on doing so many cool things, you know, and you've done all this stuff from food to manufacturing, consumer products, biotechnology, investment. So obviously you have some advice that you can give for startups now. And let's get right into that. So, and I'd like to start on the accelerator or like square one level, because let's just assume that someone has an idea. And on their approach to that, you're trying to get started. So if literally ideation stage or whatever you want to call that, you know, where's some advice that you can start to give to startups? Like, is my idea any good? Does this suck? Is this a billion-dollar idea? Like, how do you begin to form an opinion around that?
And that's a great question. And I'd like to sort of do that with you, Matt, because you founded a successful company, and it probably wasn't your first one.
No,
like Full Scale probably wasn't your first company, right?
No, there's been a few. I've participated in quite a few along the way. Matt Watson and I have invested in a number of different companies, and after doing that, we definitely learned a little bit of a mold to stick with, and some things to look at, and definitely a whole lot of things you shouldn't do as well.
Well, maybe we should get your top three there. Yeah. But like, I'll start us off that like, it is important to at least become a little bit of a fan and follow the industry that you're in. If you want to do cloud computing, there's lots of news, there's lots of services to try. And you know, having some experience, I mean, startup investors love beginners, but nobody's really a beginner, right? Just like you, you have to sort of know what's going on. And just reading the news and getting out to meetups or listening to talks is a good way to sort of like get a good foundation for your idea. You can also apply for pitch contests. Even I'm sure all through the country, there's hardly a state where you can't apply for pitch contests. And right now you don't need to travel to go to them. And just try getting out there and showing your idea out and listen to other pitches. You can go on YouTube and watch really good pitches. And then you can kind of start to get an idea of where you are on a scale of 1 to 10. And inevitably you start around 2 or 3 and then you know, you want to sort of make sure your idea's got good currency. Then you know you're probably ready to start, and it takes some time for sure.
So, you know, one of the things I think is instrumental if you have to give advice to any business, and all businesses are startups at some point. You know, Amazon had one employee at some point. Everyone's been through this stage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, first off is asking yourself, what's the problem that I'm trying to solve? And you were, you know, mentioning that by being a fan in the industry. But if you're not solving a problem, then inherently you're not that useful. One of the things that I'll look for, and you know, you talk about an accelerator, and I'm sure you went through this, is any investor or someone that's going to participate in your business or support it can also tell if you have any passion for solving that problem.
That's right. There's a lot of people, I think, who would like to be a startup person. They don't know what they're going to do. It really shows.
Yep.
I mean, this is all a matter of maturity. I mean, everybody goes through stages, right, Matt, where you think you're excited, you think you've got a great idea. And you know, when you actually compare yourself to other people that you're sort of in the same space with, that you're competing with, it may not turn out that you really have that much compared to others. And you sort of have to go back to the drawing board and come back again. If you're persistent like that, you will eventually get there. But that persistence is key, right? You got to keep trying.
Yeah, but if you're not passionate about it, you're probably going to quit when it gets hard. And you know, that's what I just see over and over again.
That's true. What I see is that people, you know, the passion can evolve as you put more effort into something.
True.
It's kind of like, you know, the first time I played softball, I really wasn't excited about it. You know, once you play through a season, you start to get interested in baseball. And that can happen too. But I think a lot of people, if they don't pick that up, I think they'll drop out because you don't get paid well as a startup, right? Your career options, if you have skills, are probably going to pay you better in a job. But it's the idea that you want to do your own thing and you want to be creative and you want to sort of steer the ship. Just that sort of idea of authorship and creativity can create the passion, right? And it's good to know yourself. A lot of people have different ideas about what that means. And they can all be successful. It's really hard to sort of put a pin in one single thing that does it. There's paths to it. If you feel strongly about it for some reason, you can get there if you're persistent.
So I love your point about becoming a fan of the market that you want to exist in. And I'll be honest, I've never heard it phrased that way. And, you know, a fan, an observer, a participant, and that's going to help you understand what the problem that needs to be solved is. Now, any business has to exist within a market. How do you go about what's your advice for defining what that market is and how difficult it could be to break into?
Well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of us have read Zero to One, but there's two or three really important points from Zero to One, which is a great book about an investor's point of view on startups and from a great founder, Peter Thiel. One of the things about it is that you really don't want to be a joiner. You want to be a sort of out on your own. It's just simply true. It's a simply true fact about all business that if you have competitors, there's going to be competition. I mean, that sounds ridiculous to have to say, but people have a tendency to get excited about something that's blowing up. And then they jump in like, oh, I love e-commerce. I want to get involved in the cloud. It's kind of late, you know, to do that right now. It doesn't mean that you can't make a good business in those fields, but it's going to be a lot more effort. If you find a problem that is unsolved and nobody else is there, that's really the best thing. And so that ability to break away from the pack and be your own person and create that way, that's a huge advantage. And that's a great signal to investors and everybody else, right? I'm not just doing this because people are enjoying it.
So I had asked this a similar question to one of my mentors. It's a guy named Lyril Holt, and Lyril was the founder of a company called CarStar, which had 100 locations after their first 18 months. And I said, well, Lyril, tell us about yourself. And he said, Matt, I'm a coward. And I said, what do you mean, man? How are you a coward? You're brave. And he goes, no. He goes, my approach to being an entrepreneur is very cowardly. He said, I love to figure out what nobody's doing. And then I go somewhere where everyone will leave me alone to get really good at it. And I was like, oh my God, I felt like I just talked to the Oracle or Yoda or maybe both, because it took me a minute to wrap my arms around it. And then, the point was, is like you mentioned, like say, oh, I want to get into cloud. Well, okay. But that's a brave approach, because you're taking on Google and Amazon and like, you know, what about David and Goliath?
Yeah.
Well, in 10,000 versions of the David and Goliath story, David won once.
The giant wins most of the time, and that's why it's such a great story. But it's even better sort of discover something new, be the only one there, and show everybody how incredibly valuable it is. And that's really the story of all these giants. Google found out that search really wasn't anywhere yet; that it was only meeting a small percentage of its potential. And Amazon, you know, everybody wanted to do e-commerce. Amazon did it well. There really wasn't that much competition when these guys started. And just by taking a little turn in the business plan and the way you do it, you can create a new market, even though it sounds similar. Like Apple, there's a lot of computers when Apple started making laptops, but they found a way to sort of create a brand that sort of created a different kind of computer. So it doesn't have to be a completely random idea that nobody cares about, but you know, at first. But the innovation has to separate you guys from other people. You know, like you know, like for us, there was this company called Memphis Meats that we invested in. And they were the first company, people have been talking about it literally since the mid 20th century, about growing meat without growing the animal. And they took all these cells from a pig, actually, and they grew them in plates in a lab, and they gathered them together, and they made a pork meatball out of it. And they weren't even the first people to do it, but their first startup to do it. And now they've been on the cover of Forbes, Fast Company. They've had hundreds of millions of dollars in their B round. And there are 70 startups doing that kind of meat right now on the face of the earth. It's one of the fastest growing sectors that we participated in. And, you know, they just really felt that it was important, and they got everybody else to believe it. So, and the first products are going to be out probably next year. So it's been a crazy ride. That's just 4 years, Matt. And so I love people who have an idea and they love it. And, you know, there's a lot of people. One thing about the PhD program is you realize that, you know, graduate students aren't much different, but they're paid to sit around and think. And you're sitting in the lab doing something someone else taught you, showed you how to do for 4 years. You start getting your own ideas. And it's really similar to people who've been working in the industry for a long time. Say you've been an engineer at a desk for 10 years. And you know that you can do the product better. And you know there's all kinds of things wrong with the company's product. And gosh, you know, this could really be, you know, a completely different thing, or there's a new idea you have. Like, that's a great place for people to start. You know, I don't think entrepreneurs have to be beginners. It's actually true that more experienced people are better entrepreneurs. It's just that young people have more free time and they have less holding them back. So everybody's got some strong point to come into being an entrepreneur if they want to sort of own their own job.
You know, when it comes to market, we're attempting to give advice to startups here. One thing that really freaks me out when someone seeks my counsel or investment is when they say, there's no one else doing this. Like, there's no one else doing it. Like, we're the only one. Now, there's two things. The reason that freaks me out a little bit is, one, I wonder if they've actually fully vetted the market and figured it out. Because I've heard people say that to me in a meeting or a pitch. And then, and like, it took me less than 5 minutes to find pages of competitors on Google. Or there possibly just isn't enough of a market that exists for what they want to do to even support a company or a business. Now, I do believe that there are riches in the niches, but, you know, so, you know, when it comes to marketplace, like, the being first is very difficult to do here in 2020 and beyond, because a lot of people are doing a lot of different stuff. I think you That's really got to get into it, because nothing is going to break your heart faster than learning that you thought you were first, only to realize that you aren't even on the lead lap of the race.
That is one of the big things that teams I work with, they have to overcome, is that they make all kinds of assumptions that simply aren't true. And you have to be prepared to hear that and be okay with that. I don't think it's possible to avoid being wrong like that, but being open to understanding where you're going wrong and quickly adjusting, I don't think that's anything less than necessary, completely necessary to survive. I also want to say, Matt, there's like different definitions of startup. So I just opened up a TikTok on entrepreneurship, and, you know, on TikTok, a startup is someone who buys like distressed goods from a warehouse and sells them on eBay, like retail arbitrage. You know, that can be a startup. Any business you start is you want to do by yourself from your own pocket at first is a startup. But there's sort of two kinds of startups that we should probably distinguish. One of them is, I'm going to start my own business. And so maybe you get a little money and you open up a dry cleaner, or you start doing retail arbitrage on eBay or Amazon. All those things are fine. And you can make some of those people become millionaires if they're really good at it. But then there's another kind of highly innovative startup that you and I are kind of talking about, where, you know, you hope that the enterprise value will become pretty large, but the ambitions are probably not something that you can do by yourself, that you probably want some help, and you probably want to get investment, right? So, and that's the kind of startup I mostly work with. I help them get ready to talk to a venture capital fund and ask for $1 to $5 million. And to do that, they have to justify eventually that their value is going to achieve 300 to a million to $1 billion enterprise value, something like that. And it seems like it's a big difference to how you're approaching it. But either way, I think I always start with how are you presenting yourself? You know, how are you aware of how people perceive you? That's one thing that all startups need, that they need to be able to speak about themselves clearly.
So
did you guys raise venture capital?
No, because we've been fortunate to have found success in the past and been able to write our own checks. It doesn't mean that it made it any less painful on some days. You know, now you gave me that, you threw it up next to the rim for me there. So thank you, Scottie Pippen. But you know, because next on my notes, I think in advice for startups, we got to talk about how to figure out what do you need? And, you know, that's a segue into the next part of advice about how to find the resources. But I think too many people in early stages really struggle to identify the resources that they need. They struggle to identify how long the runway will be, and they really struggle to understand what that path to revenue is. And in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom, I talk about path to revenue because it's different. You mentioned that different kinds of startups. We've done some episodes on that in the past. We did determine that if the name of your startup becomes a verb, you are no longer a startup, meaning Uber. We kind of laugh about what they call a startup because Uber went public and people are like, yeah, the startup Uber. I'm like, I'm not sure about that. But, you know, when it comes to what you need, most people, sometimes you have founders that have experience, and I think that they are jaded and have scars enough to overestimate what they will really need to just stay alive. But I think people that lack that experience often, now look, as a startup founder, you should be selling your big vision, but at the same time, you have to find a way to ride both optimism and realism. And just because you want to accomplish it in 6 months and think you're going to, I hate it when people are like, yeah, well, in 6 months, we'll have 20% of the market. I'm like, dude, on what planet? You know, so,
can you count?
So how, in the, it, for all the different companies that you've both worked with, founded and been involved with, how do you go about resource planning and getting some idea about what you're even seeking? Because no one's going to fund you if you have no clue about that.
That's a great question. The thing about it is that the VC investor market has become pretty, pretty conventional. Like there are some expectations that are pretty open. And so just to start, if you get investment from a venture capitalist, they're going to try to give you money on the range of 18 months, 2 years of run. So they might give you a couple $1 million, but no matter how much money they give you, in about 18 months, you're going to be looking for more because you'll be almost out. And so that means all of your timelines and productivity for a VC-funded company would be in the 18 months. You're going to set the milestones. And so you need to be a really good project manager. That's something a lot of entrepreneurs don't have, especially if they're young, like a young engineer. So there's always been someone out there to do that for them. And they need to sort of really rigorously figure out how much code they can write. What will that code do? They need to make a prototype, an MVP. They go get the investment, and then they have like clockwork. They need to hit these points. And that's kind of hard for a lot of people to learn. So before you take the investment, it'd be great if you were there already. Shoot, let me turn my phone off.
So, and while Ron runs for his phone, now I'm not sure he's fully aware that we do publish episodes, warts and all. So that's, but I'm going to use this as an example. Okay. So we had a plan to record this episode and we had some basic notes and then a phone rang and you have to make an adjustment and get up and do something. Now, look, your plan is never going to go the way that you thought it would. And that's where you're creating these buffers and understanding of what's going on. Like I've been quoting Mike Tyson way too much, but still effective in the situation. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. And if you're not ready to get punched in the face, do not open a startup because you're not going to just get punched in the face. You're going to get a battery of everything, uppercuts, jabs, hooks, body blows, low blows, all of it, it's coming. So the whole thing,
can't really prepare.
Yeah, you can't prepare for any of it. Now, you talk about writing code and doing stuff. So once again, today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. So, you know, one of the things, we do things a little differently at Fullscale because people, it's a red flag when people ask, well, how long and how much? Because I'll say, you know what, I don't know. They say, well, what do you mean you don't know how long it's going to take? Because no one knows. No one knows how long it's going to take to create software. You get an idea, but you get an idea and you're always wrong. You're always wrong because you don't know what you don't know.
Something comes up.
Yeah.
Or most likely what happens though is you know, you're going to get some working version of software and you discover that the users of the site don't use it that way.
Yep.
And then you got to write it. So the best thing I've come up with is I plan on having to start over. Like I'll just plan. I mean, just like Mike Tyson, I plan on getting punched in the face. And I'm going to tell myself, Ron needs about 15 seconds to recover from a good right hook to his jaw. And I budget that in and I don't know what it is. Right. And we just, we set a quotient on how much momentum the team needs to generate. So yeah, it's all inertial based planning. It isn't milestone. You set certain milestones, but they're very vague. And it's really about activity, especially depending on if you're in the exploratory phase. Once you've hit your MVP, you should be ready to start to ease out of that, right? That's about the time a lot of people start looking for some investment. I mean, they're still going to have surprises, but they tend to be delays on the order of weeks or a month rather than stop and rebuild, hopefully. So hopefully that thing kind of phases out or phases into new levels of activity or character as you move on. But it's a really good point, Matt. It's something people have to experience. And that's why, you know, I work with people, teams, as they go through that to sort of help shape their expectations. And I think you can't automate that. And it's one of the funnest periods though, in starting a company though, is like, hey, look what you guys found. Like, this is amazing.
So I have a very, in advice for startups, I have a very easy way to provision for this. And it's funny. So it's the oh shit line in your budget, in your budgets and your projections and everything. And this will be different for everything. I literally put a line in that says, oh shit. And people will give me their projections and everything. And then I give it back to them. And they're like, well, what's this line that says, oh shit? It's, oh shit, I didn't think about that. I didn't plan for that, or I didn't know I needed it. And it's going to be different for every type of company. And I'll make it like a percentage of expenses or projected revenue or something. Cause really there's a lot of, oh shit, items that are going to come up. All right. So So now just to kind of keep us moving down the line here, we managed to get an idea of what we thought we were going to need. Now, look, an investor or someone that's in, they know that your plan is going to change, that your projections are going to be wrong. They're trying to see an illustration of what could or can be, what you may or may not need. Now we get to the point of finding resources. And this is the part, in my opinion, where it's the hardest. On many days, it's the most infuriating. It's the most humbling for sure, which is now we've created our pitch. And I want to talk about some of that too, but like when it comes to finding or figuring out resources, let's give some advice to startups about how you can go about doing that. Where do you want to start, sir?
What I do is actually I start at the bottom. There's three ingredients or three categories of resource. There's pitch, team, and plan for me. So the plan is what the company is going to do. And we've talked about that a little bit. The team is, can you talk somebody into jumping in with you and being a co-founder? Or are you already doing this with a co-founder? Someone who can't sort of relinquish control enough and has to do everything themselves and can't share, that's usually a studies have shown it's like a 30% greater chance of failure. Learning how to work with people and those soft skills, those are very important. And not everybody starts with them, but you should expect to get them. Just like getting hit in the face. It's one of those things that happens to you. Maybe that's one of the ways you do get hit in the face. And so it's good to have, if you are surrounded by good people on the deck, it's a strong sign to the investors, and really it's something you should watch for yourself. And then the pitch is, are you going to be able to create a good outward-facing impression of people? Do you know how to communicate? People think that that their technical plan will be so brilliant, any idiot can see, and they're just going to shove the money over. But even if you are that good, the investors know, and everybody else knows, that if you can't work with people, if you can't make agreements, if you can't create allies in partners, it better be incredibly brilliant. I can't think of a single company that made it simply on the power of their tech. You know, Tesla's got design for their cars. Apple's is mostly design. It's the tech itself is kind of all subservient to the functionality of their products. Everybody needs to talk to customers. And if you're ignoring that, that's a huge weakness too. So all those things matter. You need to work on all of those. Those are the three categories of resources anyway.
I love that. I love that, by the way. So the pitch, I think sometimes people undervalue like the power of just a hot presentation. Yeah. You know, I mean, we use the two words a lot around our office, world class. And we always want that to be the mentality that we have approaching a presentation. We just created some investment docs that went out and we're literally told this is the best presentation we've ever seen. And okay, mm-hmm. So that's world class, because you can win or lose on that. And so don't be afraid to find some help or get into some, like, you know, when it comes to a pitch, I think too many people get down to the nitty gritty, get the show on the road. Like, you know, like you shouldn't be 5 minutes into it. And okay, I actually was in a pitch once, and we're here at the 10 minute mark, and someone else sitting there said, "Hey man, what do you do?" Like, you know, like think about it. Like, and we were all thinking it. So the thing is, how about starting with that? Like, what do you do? Well, who are you? What do you do? What's your problem you solve? What's your opportunity? There you go.
You have hit the nail on the head. And anybody, I mean, you got to have some empathy for these people who have all this money, because I mean, they have their pain, right? And one of the pains is actually listening to people talk.
Oh God, it's
bad. You know what? Recently, this summer, my record is 20 minutes. Like, I listened to someone talk, not a single word of interruption for 20 minutes. He did not say what his company does.
Yeah,
it's incredible how long.
What do you do? Right.
Here's my prescription. So everybody hates the elevator pitch. That's because they're no good at it. You got a great one. Nobody even knows they're getting it from you, right? And it just rolls off your tongue. I have them too. You have to be able to understand the essence of your company and what makes it so special. And you should say it so clearly. It shouldn't take you longer than 15 seconds.
I agree.
If you do it really well, everybody who's good, everybody who's successful has one of those, by the way, right?
They have more than one, Ron. I get a lot of people that ask me about this because they say, "Wow, you do a great job of presenting what you want in small, medium, or large packets." And but that's the thing is, so I look at it, I tell people, I think of it as like having a deck of cards, except for you're not dealing them face down. Like, I know what card I need to get a blackjack. And in some cases, it depends on, I even have cards that will help you describe or introduce me. So like why leave it to chance? Now, I use this phrase, and I don't know if I've invented it or whatever. I refer to it as fact shaping. So there is an infinite amount of ways that you can say anything. Literally an infinite amount of combinations. That means some of them have to be way better than others. And that also means some are terrible. So I spend a lot of time looking at words. Like, you're not cheap, you're affordable. And just different stuff like that, that I think a lot of people don't give credence to. Now, and so much of that is like, you can undersell yourself very quickly. But when you're giving this pitch, so the people you're talking to are likely type A. Okay. And they hear a lot of pitches. And the thing is, you will make people go numb get right into it. Like, if you can give a 3-minute pitch for your whole business that's super effective, they'll probably thank you. They'll probably say thank you.
I think your listeners appreciate, like, they're really hearing the insights dope from you, which is great. I mean, ladies and gentlemen at home, that was very high level, right? The pitch should be different for whoever you're talking to. A really good, if you're really good at business, you're looking into their eyes and you're going to just basically reach out and touch them with your words. And they're going to feel something, right? The worst thing that can happen is to bore an investor.
Yep.
They lose their attention, you've lost them, and you've lost the money too. So, you know, for beginners, I like to say you need a hook. It's just an attention-grabbing phrase. It doesn't really necessarily say what you do.
Lead with the need. Right? My book editor, he used to say that to me like so often, and it just stuck with me. And I'm like, his name's Patrick Price. Amazing book editor, but it's edited a dozen New York Times bestsellers. And the only reason that my books don't suck, to be honest, because I'm not a great writer. I have a great editor. But you got to lead with the need. So, you know, that whole, because that's what gets people's attention. And I've carried that into so many different things that I've done. Like, what's the problem you solve? Or something else. Now, we'll move down the line here. So, team.
Let me give you another spin on that. Go ahead. That is a great way of doing it. A lot of people want to say, what are the problem you're solving? And for you to just get right to it. And that can really grab a lot of attention. But there's another category of pitch. Remember that the essence of a good pitch is to continue a conversation. Yeah. When you say something and people go, tell me more about that, or what do you mean about that? That's really the like definition of a successful pitch, right? Let's go have coffee, right? So there's a whole other category of pitch that literally doesn't say anything about anything. It just invites conversation. So an example I had is there's an executive I heard a talk from, and he said there was a guy whose company made copper wire. And he would tell people, when he asked what he would do, he says, I light the world. Right. And he's got a really nice suit. And so he's doing something. And people inevitably want to know what it is he's doing. Right. Apples was think different, for instance, as well. So if you can really connect something profound sounding to what you do, that's another approach. So I think in terms of impact and less about information for the at least half the elevator pitch.
Well, you want to spark interest. You want to get some involvement. And here's the thing is get straight to the point where you can get those listening to ask the questions that are important to them. And now you're engaging people, and you also have the ability. So I want to move on to the team part of this, because here's the thing is if you're a real expert at what you do, you're going to shine at this part of the pitch. Now, we have had so many people on the show that have been investors, and I've been very unscientifically polling all of them. Who do you like to bet on? Do you bet on the jockey or the horse? And overwhelmingly, it's almost unanimous. I think it might even be unanimous. It's the jockey. So now, not everybody is a Kentucky Derby winning jockey. So now, if you've done it, you're a subject matter expert, you're passionate about it, or perhaps if you found success in the past, you have an easier road to getting funded, because the investors know and understand that people that have found success in the past have a way of figuring that out. Now, and still in Congress with the pitch, don't undersell you. You know, one of the greatest bits of advice I've heard about a pitch and a presentation is don't be afraid to sell your big vision. And, you know, and I'm the person to get you, and I'm the person that will take us there. And okay, if they want to ask why after, that's fine. But you know, now if you're not a prize winning jockey, you are going to have to win. You're going to have to sell the horse. So that can be a little more plan centric. But what are your comments related to that?
Well, my comments about this, first of all, like people can hear that advice and they don't really understand why it's such great advice. The reason why Matt's advice is so good is because if you sanely look at what you've got, if you're real honest with yourself, how much is that company worth right now? It's worth nothing.
Nothing.
All of the potential is in the future. And the only instrument by which that valuation is going to be realized is through the people implementing it. If they give up on anything, if they're lazy in any way, if they get demoralized, if they don't have the smarts or the abilities, it doesn't matter what the idea is. So, I mean, obviously the best pitches have both, right? You want people who are going to execute an idea that's incredibly valuable. That's a grade A pitch, right? Content and execution.
I think people sometimes are a little sheepish about talking about their past failures. I wouldn't ever make an investment in someone that hadn't failed at some point. And the reason is until you fail and you like, until you get punched in the face by Mike Tyson and hit the mat, most entrepreneurs have a strong belief that they're bulletproof. You think you're bulletproof until you realize you aren't. And I actually like that because I don't want to be the one whose money you learn that with. So I think it's okay. I think it's okay to say, you know what? I've tried a couple things. They didn't go well. This is what happened. I'm past it. I've learned this from it. And this is why that's going to help me get to where I need to be.
Yeah, you're communicating resilience there. You're communicating your ability to adapt. Basically, another way of putting it is, I don't want to invest in anybody who hasn't had any mistakes, because they're just admitting they just won't admit they've had any mistakes. That's a double strike against you. Being really vulnerable can be a great show of strength. That resilience shows in many ways, right? You've got to really be authentic. If you can be authentic and open with people, that's the best way to be. Being vulnerable is just delusion, right?
Yeah, so
I totally think
you had three pillars. You had the pitch, the team, and the plan. Now, we've already mentioned a few things with the plan. Like, it's okay. Like, I would love it if you came with your plan and had an oh shit line, I'd be like, okay, this person's actually thinking this out. What are some things that you see? Where are some things and places that you see some common and repetitive failure when it comes to looking at someone's plan?
So, you know, and a lot of those come from, you can get around a lot of your common failures by understanding what the life and mindset of an investor is. And being honest, the whole point of investing in you is for them to make a lot of money. If they don't do that, because they got that money from someone else, if they can't return that money plus a lot more, and you know, that's the end of their career. That's it. It's just suicide to invest in something that's not going to become much more valuable in the future. So a lot of people, they come with plans where the main benefit is they're going to solve a problem and help a lot of people. But then they forget that they don't need that, their plan doesn't include in that company making profits. And that's evil capitalism to some people. But when the employees cannot be paid, when you have to close down offices and open them up again because your revenues are like a roller coaster, that is not a stable business. And you're really not helping anybody. Economic stability is sustainability overall. And so people, sometimes they get so idealistic about the problem they're solving, they completely forget about being profitable. And you know, if you're solving a problem, like a very common problem is, how do we empower the American farmer? Most farms are closing. Most farms are barely making any money. It's a very serious problem. And a lot of wonderful people are jumping in to try to help. But if you're so busy helping the farmers that you can only support 30 customers, you don't have any impact, right? And so people often forget about the economics. And another thing about the economics is that some people think, I'm really sure thing because I've got a great plan to reach a $20 million enterprise value. I'll be there in a couple of years, maybe 5 or 6, and all I need is a couple million dollars. Do it. That sounds like a really safe bet and returns 100% over 10 years or something like that. Well, the reason that a venture capitalist wants to see someone with basically a potential of 100x value improvement over the next decade is that if you look at investing that money, that first investment doesn't really give them a profit. Because if you took the money that a venture capital investor is going to give to you and put it in a T-bill, it'll double in 10 years. And it's much, much safer than you are. So you really need to have an idea and a plan that's going to expand, maybe not 100-fold, but 10, 20, 30-fold. It needs to be ambitious and it needs to have impact. Investors also like something they can brag about to their friends. And if nobody's ever heard of you, you're not very braggable. So all of those things are meaningful to the people that you're talking to. Those are the most common mistakes. You know, I mean, I can be small and safe is one of the most common ones.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I see is an over-reliance on something significant occurring too quickly. So just meaning like, you know, I mentioned earlier, like, hey, well, in 6 months, we'll have 20% of the market. And if that doesn't occur, it's over. And that is not being realistic. That is being overly optimistic. Because, like, and another thing too that I'll tell you right now, and in the episode about advice for startups, no investor, no VC at least, wants to hear you come to the meeting and say, after you put money in, we'll never have to raise money again. Those are like famous last words. Like, and everybody I know has always said that right before the next time they raise money. Okay. But you know,
put on the list of things that sound good to you that do not sound good to investors.
Yeah,
totally true.
Yeah, doesn't sound great. And another thing with that is, well, we don't really need $1 million, but we're asking for it. Also, not good to say. Yeah.
Another great thing, a really horrible thing to say is, we do everything. This product does everything, which means kind of like, you know, you really need to be able to do one thing. Yep. If you're out there trying to develop 10 products, you're not going to make it. That's another good one.
While we're rolling with that, that is a great point, because in your plan, it should focus on you becoming great at one thing and not six at the same time. I see that in the planning phase and also in the early stage. And I've talked to a lot, you know, I've had people that are like, hey, man, will you just sit down and like tell me why I'm not getting what I want? And almost every time is that the business or the founder is trying to be good at six things before they're good at one. And, you know
what a really
dominant
good
with one. Yeah. Yeah.
This is such an interesting topic. Like, everybody just coming up with stories. Like, that reminds me of a story. So I remember when I was a first managing engineering for a software project, you know, you think that $2 million in funding for 18 months is a lot of money. It isn't. In my job, working in a pretty big company when I was doing engineering, that was enough for two engineers to work for a year on a project with all the infrastructure, all the resources they needed. That was one software project, even in the old company I was in. You can't really, people just don't know how to do their own accounting. So if you're in a job and you want to become an entrepreneur, keep your eyes open, talk to your supervisor, try to understand the budget. All of your entire life, all those things around you will get you ready to sort of like give yourself a more realistic picture when you're on your own.
So once again with me today, I've got Ron Shigeta. Ron's an entrepreneur, an investor, and an innovator. He's done a whole lot of stuff. This is a very stimulating conversation. So now, many of the things that you've heard us talk about, we're trying to do nothing other than prepare you for the brutal reality of owning a startup. And, you know, like, I want you to be optimistic and I want you to sell your big vision. At the same time, we want you to come in prepared and we want you to come in ready, because in some cases you get one shot. And, you know, I think that's a really important part. So now let's just say that we have navigated these treacherous, shark-infested waters in which we were swimming. We weren't even in a boat. We were trying to get in the boat. And now we're going to get to the point where we have someone that's interested in putting some money or some resource into what we're doing. Now, look, that's a good thing, but there's some things that I think you need to be wary of as well. And I've seen some people make some pretty shitty deals and some pretty bad things that prevent them from doing some stuff later. So I think some of the best advice we can give for startups is to talk about that. Now, I'll give an example. So recently recently I saw $1 million offer that had $100,000 a year management fee for the investor on it.
Holy cow.
Not a good deal.
Wow.
That's a 10% that yield on $1 million. Yeah. So like, I mean, think about that. And the question is what? So, well, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'll take that deal, but in some cases, but you know, there's a lot of things. I think that one of the things that first confused me years ago, like you have different kinds of notes and approaches and this and that, like, where do you want to start here, Ron? Cause like realistically, we could probably do a 3-part series on this, but I mean, what are some basics?
Well, I think the people are getting a great deal today because, you know, they're really hearing your experience too, Matt. I think I'm really enjoying this too. I think just hearing you, but I think basically right now, I would say there's categories of investors and there's categories of instruments, that is say documents. I think the investor landscape is changing super rapidly, Matt. Back when I started investing in the Stone Ages about 6 years ago, maybe there were like 20 or 30 venture capital firms on the planet. That's paleolithic, man.
They're everywhere
there
now.
There are hundreds of them. They're geographically everywhere. In fact, I want to give a shout out to Stray Dog Capital and Lisa Feria in Kansas City, Missouri, across the river. And on the other end of the state there is the Yield Lab. That's a great accelerator for ag tech and farm tech and food tech. Like, the funds are everywhere now, and they have a lot of money. There isn't a scarcity of funds at all or opportunities. Right. But what we want to do is, so you want to break down the investors into sort of professional investors. They vary with the size of the fund. They can have between 10 to $1 billion under management. but they tend to be very reliable. They don't tend to ask for eccentric things. Then there are smaller investors, and those fall into two categories, the sort of like off the wall kind and the very sort of like sort of suit and tie kind of put people. The some more proper people, they will either use a convertible loan note or they use something called a safe. The convertible loan note is a form of loan, and it's actually characterized as a loan, but it's really kind of an investment. And then the safe is actually a promise to buy shares later for a set price, or for a range of prices. And those are great because they do not value your company, and you think you'd like to have an enterprise value where the stock is exchanged for price. But unless someone who's really reputable is giving you that price, it's really a bad idea for you because it really sets people off. Like, it makes you very suspicious. It's like saying, oh, my mom gave me money for this and she priced it at $50 million.
Nope.
You know, that's the size of the company. You just don't want that scenario. So these unpriced instruments are much more popular now. And under, you know, for your first money in between $1 and $2 million, you may not have any pricing instruments at all. You'll just wait and eventually come along. The pricing instruments called a term sheet usually, and that is just basically, we give you money, you give us some shares, but you want someone people trust to give you that to price you, right? So that's one thing. And the other thing is the off the wall kind of investor. So basically the problem with these things is they are contracts. They can have many, many provisions. They can be as few as 3 pages. They can be, you could be measuring them in like half inches.
In volumes, yeah, in volume, like weigh them, right. You weigh them to see how many pages there are because there's that many.
And Matt, have you gotten and you've given these, aren't they scary?
I hate it. You know, I was mentioning earlier, like the phrase that investors don't want to hear is I won't have to raise money again. You mentioned so any type of convertible note, and I'm going to speak as the guy that dropped out of 5 colleges and make this as basic as possible because these are confusing. So what is convertible about that note is that when some future occurrence takes place, like another investment round, or maybe the end of a time frame, or something like that, the investor has the ability to either leave that as debt that may need to be repaid, or to convert that investment into some kind of ownership in the company. Now, it's safe. So what's a safe note? Simple agreement for future equity. This is a, now Ron's out in California, which is the birthplace of the safe note, the Valley, especially, okay. And Y Combinator, a very well-known accelerator, was pushing this out because what a safe note does is in the earliest stages of your business, no one knows what it's worth. No one cares about how much of your own money you're put in or your mom's money you've put in. They do begin to care when other institutional vessels or money comes in because that sets a real street price on it. Like you said, you can't say I have a $2 million valuation because my mom put $20,000 in at that valuation. But you know, both of these kind of notes are good for you. Now they typically have a capped value or a discount that may occur for a number of different reasons. Really, you just got to understand some basics about them. But one of the things, and we talked about like bad deals that can hamstring you later, are, okay, so if a note doesn't convert, and that's a huge red flag for a later investor because they're sitting there going, okay, mm-hmm. So someone put, we'll just say $100. Someone put $100 mm-hmm. into X Corp here, and then they didn't want that to convert. The question is why? And now on the flip right. side of that too, sometimes these notes are written with weird provisions that give levels of control or certain things that are going to make you very unattractive mm-hmm. to investors later. Some of those might be, okay, well, Ron, I'm going to put $1 million in your company, but I want $5 million worth of a future option at that same price. So here's the thing is now you've capped your total valuation at $4 million and they're sitting on the ability to at any time dilute everybody's interest in the business at a way low price that could occur 5 years later. So, you know, really in the end, just find some legal counsel and help that can give you good advice about what you're signing. And look, it's okay. I as a salesperson, I say there's two four-letter words mm-hmm. that matter: sold and next. Don't be afraid to negotiate terms, and don't be afraid to move on. Because if someone's giving you an opportunity, it's likely that there is someone else that might as well. So, and you also can't have an auction without two bidders. So get out there and look for it and try to figure it out. Like, I mean, you look, if you're the only bidder on eBay, the price is static. If two people bidding against each other, it can become infinite. But, you know,
that it can move, right?
That basic understanding. And there's, you know, like I said, we, and you're aware too, we could talk about this for hours and days because there's so many different things. You know, there's a book called Venture Deals by Brad Feld that is very popular that, you know, look, now Brad's a tech founder and an investor, but it's written for founders by founders. And I think that's important because it's, you know, it's like, hey, this is the thing. And, you know, there are situations, but, you know, there's a lot to look out for. And really in the end, now you talk about volumes. Okay. So if you're only trying to raise like $100,000 and you're getting this term sheet or this deal package that's 160 pages, you might have a legal bill that's half that by the time you're done.
Yeah. Just getting someone to read through that once. That's a problem. I mean, that's one of the reasons the safe is great is because the safe is very conventional and it's very thin.
You know, like I've seen them two pages.
Yeah, and they're very straightforward, and that's great. That saves everybody a lot of trouble. And you can pretty much, you know, if you do have an attorney, it's not going to be very much talking Correct. You're going to do. But convertible loan note is a regular contract, and people write it every which way, and they'll ask for insane things. That's kind of the off the wall warning I'm giving you. Like if people are wanting to define their own terms, they'll ask for all kinds of crazy things. On the other hand, Matt, there is a situation where, you know, nobody else is showing up. There's one person. Sometimes you are forced to take those terms. True. And I have seen it. It's not pretty, but I always want to say, like, you know, it's better to live than to die. So those things happen. But in that case, at least read every word yourself, so that you have some idea what you're going into. A lawyer can charge $10,000 to read a thick contract. So
when it comes to advice, we're still on advice for startups. So look, I think one of the biggest mistakes that I see people make is believing that the process of fundraising will be remotely fast. It is freaking slow, people. Like, yeah. I mean, typically, like when it comes to true institutional money, you're looking at 4 to 6 months sometimes for a yes or a no, and maybe another 3 months to close it. That's a 7 to 9 month time frame. So where I see people make mistakes is like they've got like 40 days of runway and they're just beginning to like try to raise money. And depending on where you're at, like if you're going for angel money and it's a small amount, you might be able to pull that off. But I mean, what's your experience for the timeline in closing these deals?
I've never seen anybody turn around, even start a funding round in 2 months. There are some events like at the end of an accelerator where 150 investors have just seen you. You might be able to close some money pretty quick after that. And those are great opportunities if you can get into a good accelerator. But for the most part, you're dead on. I say it's really important not to run out of money in that 6 to 9 months either, because once you have no cash and you got to start begging or go home, then the terms get a lot tougher, don't they? The investors are your friends, kind of, but they will take advantage of the market. If you put yourself in a squeeze, that's not a good thing to be when you're talking to investors.
Well, let's talk about that real quick, because I think one thing that's important and my advice to any startup is you have to keep in mind that until they sign the deal and deposit the check, it's the investor's job to get the best deal for them. And, you know, I think sometimes people make this mistake like, oh, they're my buddy. No, they're not until they sign it and it's done. Like they can be, but you got to be careful about that. Because remember, like it's their job to get the best deal for them. And you want to do business with people that seem to have the best interest of the business. You're looking for things that aren't self-serving and people that seem like they're wanting to invest in the overall business's growth and exit and all of that. Not, like I mentioned, having some stupid, you know, gratuity that's in there that's going to bleed you dry along the way.
Yeah, let's expand on that, Matt, because it's in general, when you get into business, you have to learn how to put your business hat on. And it's a strange place to be, and it's a strange world compared to what most people experience. There really isn't such a thing as a friend the way that you think of a friend from college or from the ball team. You know, everybody has to make money in business. And like that investor may be your friend, but the definition of friend does not include them not doing their job. And I have seen investors argue over something like a tenth of a percentage point just to sort of like squeeze their margins up just because it's compulsively their job. And that you should never take that as an unfriendly thing. You shouldn't get mad at that, but it should also expect it to happen. There is nobody so close to you that they will not try to. They have to make a good deal for themselves.
Yeah.
Right? It's a different.
And I think a lot of people also in this part of the process, and it can be a negotiation, you know, a term sheet isn't necessarily a static thing until you're signing it and moving towards closing the deal. Now, you know, you need to expect objections. You're going to have a lot of them. Now, seasoned salespeople know and understand that a buyer without objections usually doesn't buy. They're not actually a buyer. They're kicking tires. Like it's normal for any buyer, which an investor is a buyer in you and what you're doing and your opportunity, to have objections. And in some cases, they're going to want to beat you up. They're going to want, well, I know you're asking for $5 million valuation, but you've got like all these problems and all this stuff that's wrong. And it's probably like, you're probably not worth $5 million, Ron. You're probably worth like 2.5, because look at this list of things. There's so much stuff. We'll probably be able to help you with some of that, but I don't know if we can do $5 million. The thing you really need to be, that should be running through your head there is, then why are you still talking to me? Because if this opportunity is so bad and you don't like what we have to offer, then why are you still here? You know, and think that in your head, because that's all just part of the process. They beat you up a little bit. Yeah, I'm not saying everyone's going to do that, but that's a pretty common thing.
I think, well, there's another thing too there. Another thing pops into my head when you tell that story is, another thing to ask yourself is like, what if I just give them and give them what they want? That's a horrible signal. It's like saying, I'm a wimp. I'm just going to, if someone pushes me, I'm just going to like fold like a piece of tissue paper. It's really good to push back against those things. And you don't want to argue angrily, but you will definitely want to be able to put up a fight and show them that you're sticking to your guns. Because in the long run, remember the resilience point we talked about earlier in the discussion here, right? They want people who are going to be tough. If you show those people that you're a good negotiator, your value may go up just from that.
Yeah, and here's the thing: it takes some courage to do that, and that's something that you're not gonna offend them. I mean, you gotta be like, you gotta answer with some logic. You can't just start screaming and yelling. But say, you know what, Ron? I appreciate you mentioning the things that we're aware of what our shortcomings are. We already have planned and provisioned to fix all of these things. Your investment will help accelerate that process. That said, I can't accept a penny less than that $5 million I mentioned, because honestly, I think that's a little low. I really think that we have,
right. Matt's got all this experience. Like, I would just go back over the principal values, and like, he's there because of those values for sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's ever a reason to just like take that argument without any argument at all. Like, I think that's really a bad thing to do, just give them what they want. And that goes back to the business negotiation sort of ethics we talked about before. It's the same thing. They want to see if you understand that. There's all kinds of tests like that. And most of them are just emotional and conversational like that. Personality tests, resilience tests. You got to pass them.
Yeah. And I think some of that too, is like you mentioned, like, what do you act? All right. So it's a pretty known psychological fact that people don't operate at their highest level when they are stressed or when they're under pressure. So some of that's wanting to see where you're at. Now, here we are. We've been talking about this for an hour. I think we've given some great advice for startups and what I'm going to call volume one. There's so much to wrap your arms around here. Now, I don't want to keep you too much longer here. So I actually want to stop this. And like I said, I want to fully invite you to come back for a volume two down the road. Because we haven't even talked about growth, go-to-market strategies, how to handle a business that's growing quickly, how to handle one that's middling, how to deal with an exit. So
I probably spend 120 hours with the team that I'm really advising that's going well. You know what I mean? Yeah. It just goes on and on. I would love, and you know, what I love is you're telling your story, Matt. I mean, your bio is super great, but I think people can see you've been in the trenches. And I just, I'm really enjoying the conversation.
Yeah. And I think, well, that's been the whole mantra of Startup Hustle is like, what's the realistic view of, you know, being an entrepreneur and being a startup founder. And it's really funny because our new director of strategic partnership, she said, Matt, you know what? I like your episodes because I can tell you don't give a shit. And I was like, well, I'm going to need you to expand on that. She goes, no, I meant just about telling the truth and laying it out there. Like, I think that realistic, raw, honest, like, this is what this is what Hollywood says you'll see, and then this is what you'll really see, because they're very, very different. And, you know, the thing is, with all the stuff that we mentioned, that doesn't mean that any of that's going to be part of your own path. It doesn't mean that you're going to experience the same. I mean, you just have two people here that have, you know, been a party to, it's a combination of experience, other people's war stories, maybe good or not good advice that we've gotten. And, you know, with that, I want to go ahead and move towards the founder's freestyle, which is the way we end episodes of Startup Hustle. And once again, today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Now, with the founder's freestyle, and oh man, this could almost be its own episode because we covered so many things. Based on what we talked about in this episode, Ron, like, what's the best advice that you can give a founder overall?
I really think it's going into learning mode. You know, it's actually pretty common advice, but surround yourself with excellent people that raise your standards and raise your own expectations for the kind of performance you need to give. And you will always float to the top of the stack. That's really the best thing. I mean, people don't know what they're competing against. That's the toughest part of being a founder. You talk to an investor, you don't know the last 20 people they talked to and what they said. And as you get us, so you have to always be thinking about tuning up, always.
I think that's great advice. I'm going to parlay off that a little bit, because I think one of the things is you got to be prepared to play a numbers game. And, you know, it depends on who you are, what you're offering and how you do it. But if you think you're going to go out and try to pitch five people and you're going to get what you want, like try like 500. You know, every bit of resource or opportunity that you're chasing has got a different story behind it. Like a lot of that, you may find five funds, but they might not have, they might be max. They might already have their money out. They might be doing something different.
They may have already invested in something just like you about 20 minutes before they talk.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay. Yeah. And you know, the thing is you got, and the next thing is it's a sales process. So, you know, as a salesperson, your money is made and lost by the way you handle your objections. And it's also made and lost with your ability to follow up. So keep in mind that people that have money and resources and stuff to invest, and especially if it's known, there's a lot of people asking them for it. And seasoned investors are like a very disciplined hitting champion in baseball. The best hitters of all time in baseball didn't swing at every pitch. In fact, they only wait for, it's not about it just being in the strike zone. It's even down to what part of the strike zone it's in. So, you know, so many of the guests we've had in the past that are investors from all different ways, shapes, and forms, they're sitting back and waiting for their pitch. So get your pitch where it needs to be. Get it in front of a lot of people. Be prepared to hear no a lot and ignore it. Have a short, short memory for the word no and just keep moving down the line.
It's all about getting back home again. That's what you really care about. It doesn't happen every time.
Are you going to join me for a volume two of this down the road?
I cannot wait to come back, Landon. There's so much more. And I mean, I really like listening to your stories too. I mean, I think it's great people getting some straight up talk on the Startup Hustle. And
yeah. This is really hey, man, I'm coming from the heart of flyover country and the 25th biggest media market in the country, man. Like, we're not in Silicon Valley. I'm in Kansas City. Like, I'm just saying, like, it's like a very realistic approach to a lot of different stuff. Like, I'm not sure that half the investors here know what AI even means or did a few years ago. Like, no offense, guys, if you're listening, don't take it the wrong way, but you know, most of us are in that situation and not in downtown San Francisco, New York, Boston.
The good news is you don't have to be in San Francisco anymore. Yeah. You can be anywhere. Yep. You can make it. You just have to put yourself at the right level.
With that, I'll see you next time, Ron.
All right. Thanks a bunch.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.